Good afternoon, Your Honor. Teresa Reniker on behalf of Jennifer Tobitz, and I'm going to be splitting the argument here today with my co-counsel, Mr. Minter. I'll be addressing the plan interpretation issues. If the court agrees with us on the meaning of the plan, it can end the analysis there. However, Mr. Minter will be addressing the constitutional issues, and his presentation will underscore why it's unnecessary to reach a constitutional question in this case. This case is a garden variety ERISA benefits claim involving the application of plan eligibility criteria to determine whether Jennifer Tobitz is a spouse within the meaning of the Cozen O'Connor retirement plan. What's unique and important about this case is that in arguing for their interpretation of the plan, the Farleys, at least up until today, and Cozen O'Connor have contended that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act controls the meaning of terms in private employer benefit plans. That would be a radical expansion of DOMA's reach, extending DOMA far beyond its intended public sector scope and into private sector employment relationships. And I want to note that of all the individuals and entities who are weighing in on this case, the Farleys and Cozen have been alone in taking that position, and now it appears that the Farleys have abandoned it. Neither the United States nor the House Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group nor any of the amici endorses the position that DOMA controls the terms of private contracts. In fact, the amicus brief of Professor George, which supports the constitutionality of DOMA, agrees with our position on the reach of DOMA. He writes in his brief at pages 30 and 31 that DOMA does not touch private behavior or dictate how private institutions should regard same-sex unions. He writes that people are left free to form same-sex partnerships, and states, religious communities, businesses, and other institutions are left free to treat them as marriages. The only thing that DOMA does, Professor George writes, is to decide which arrangements the federal government may recognize as marital unions. And we agree with Professor George on this crucial point. There is no support in the text of DOMA or in its legislative history for the notion that DOMA precludes private employers from using the term spouse to refer to same-sex spouses in their benefits plans, along with opposite-sex spouses. Indeed, many thousands of ERISA-regulated employee benefit plans currently provide benefits to same-sex spouses. Now, our opponents seem to recognize this based on the argument we just heard, but at the same time, they seem to argue that a plan can't use the term spouse to provide such benefits. They seem to argue that a plan has to find some other language to use to provide benefits to a same-sex spouse, that it can't just use the term spouse. And that's
beneficiary.
Excuse me?
Beneficiary.
Beneficiary, although beneficiary, unlike spouse, is a term that's defined in ERISA. A beneficiary is anyone who is or may become eligible for a benefit under the terms of a plan because of the terms of the plan or because of a designation by a participant.
But
so,
I did not get the impression that the Farley's argument was essentially that they were laying down on the issue of same-sex beneficiary here, same-sex marriage, partner being a beneficiary. In other words, it's my understanding their position is you can write it in as a beneficiary, and if they happen to be of the same sex, so be it. But they cannot by default become the spouse.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that they're arguing that the plan, for example, this plan, could provide can provide all the spousal benefits that it provides with that term being interpreted to include only opposite-sex spouses, and then write in some separate set of provisions for same-sex spouses using some other term.
But they're also arguing that in this case, that Ms. Tobitz is not going to receive any money.
They are, and we've heard a new argument today that that Ms. Tobitz doesn't meet the definition of the term spouse under the terms of the plan on the basis that she and Ms. Farley were not married for 1 year prior to Ms. Farley's death. And that's kind of a ludicrous argument. Everybody up to this point has agreed that they were married beginning in 2006, and no court has held that their Canadian marriage license is null and void, as Mr. Breen argued. And there's certainly no basis for this court to hold that that marriage license is null and void. It's a valid Canadian marriage license, and it's recognized in Illinois. The marriage is recognized in Illinois as a civil union. We've submitted our request for judicial notice.
How do you resolve the conflict between the definition of civil union and ADOMA in Illinois?
You know, that's a question to some extent for the Illinois courts, but the Illinois statute itself is very clear. It says the term party to a civil union means and shall be included in any definition or use of the term spouse, family, immediate family, dependent, next of kin, and other terms that denote the spousal relationship as those terms are used throughout the law.
How does that reconcile with the Illinois DOMA?
It seems to me that what the Illinois DOMA is saying is something very narrow, which is that Illinois is not going to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. But the Illinois comp stats that I just cited, which was 75/10, and other components of the civil union law make clear that a marriage like the Tobits-Farley marriage will be treated as a marriage in Illinois, even though Illinois would not issue a marriage license. The statute says a marriage between persons of the same sex legally entered into in another jurisdiction, such as Canada, shall be recognized in Illinois as a civil union. So Illinois is recognizing this marriage. It's treating the partners to the marriage as spouses for all purposes under Illinois law. And the Illinois probate court, as Your Honor has directed a question to this, has found that Ms. Tobits is a surviving civil union partner. And when the Illinois probate court made that determination, it had before it the facts that the Farleys consider significant. It knew that the marriage was entered in Canada in 2006, and it knew that Ms. Farley had died before the civil union law became effective. And nonetheless, it said that Ms. Tobits is a surviving party to a civil union. That determination, you know, is being made today. So this is not about the retroactivity of the Illinois statute. The determination whether Ms. Tobits is a surviving spouse is a question for the court today, not a question that's being decided in 2010.
Does a Canadian court have to declare that the Canadian same-sex marriage law is null and void in order for the Farley position to stand?
I think that a court would have to say, would have to agree with Mr. Breen that this marriage license was null and void.
Would it have to be a Canadian court, or could it be a United States court?
I would imagine that it would have to be a court of the jurisdiction that issued the marriage license. In other words, I don't think that courts typically are determining the validity of marriage licenses issued by other jurisdictions. So, yes, I would say that this is a valid marriage. It has not been determined to be invalid by any court. It's recognized in Illinois, and it was recognized in Canada. And it's important to place this in the context of the administration of ERISA plans. ERISA plan administrators, as Mr. Breen said, are bound to follow the express terms of the plan. They don't reach out beyond the plan to investigate the validity of marriages in particular jurisdictions or to determine the application of state laws. The purpose of ERISA is to enable employers to set up nationally uniform systems of plan administration that are not where they're not bound by state laws. And I would make two points in that connection. First of all, this is not a case like many that have been cited in the briefs, where there are multiple marriages and the court is in the position of having to examine which of these multiple marriages is the marriage that's going to be recognized for purposes of benefits under a plan. That's not necessary here because there is only one spouse. The other point that I would make is that I disagree with Mr. Breen's point about the Kennedy and Egelhoff cases out of the Supreme Court. He said in those cases the state laws were preempted by ERISA because they conflicted with ERISA's spousal provisions. That's not correct. In fact, in Kennedy and Egelhoff, the spouses were both ex-spouses. They were both divorced. The point in Kennedy was that even though the spouse, there was a divorce decree in which the spouse had disclaimed all interest in the participant's benefits, because the participant hadn't changed his beneficiary designation and the plan bound the administrator to follow the beneficiary designation no matter what, the plan administrator had to give the benefits to the ex-spouse. So, and Egelhoff is a similar situation. So when we argue that Pennsylvania law is preempted here, that's very significant. Cozen deliberately wrote its choice of law provision to select only non-preempted Pennsylvania law, not all Pennsylvania law, only that Pennsylvania law that would not be preempted by ERISA. And all state laws that relate to employee benefit plans, unless they fall within certain exceptions specified in the statute, all state laws are preempted by ERISA. For that very reason, to allow plan administrators to establish their own nationally uniform systems of plan administration. And so Pennsylvania law, if it dictates, if it purports to dictate to a plan administrator who is a spouse, who to distribute benefits to under the terms of the plan, is clearly preempted, and therefore it's not brought within the ambit of this choice of law provision. I'd like to address Your Honor's question about the ambiguity of the term spouse in the plan. Is there an ambiguity? And we contend that the plan is unambiguous on its face. The plan specifically defines spouse as the person to whom the participant has been married for at least a year, and the ordinary and common usage of the term spouse is a person in a marriage, a person who is married, without reference to the sex of the spouse. So this is an unambiguous definition of the term spouse.
The interpretation or the application, if it is to be applied, of PA DOMA and or DOMA make it? Render it ambiguous?
Right. The choice of law provision does not introduce an ambiguity because it specifically incorporates only non-preempted state law, and a state law that purported to tell a plan administrator who's a spouse would clearly be preempted under this line of cases, under ERISA's express terms and the line of cases including Kennedy, Egelhoff, Boggs, and so forth. You know, even where a contract term is not expressed on its face, it can suffer from a latent ambiguity, and that's the Baldwin case that we've cited from the Third Circuit, the case where the court needed to determine whether the term children in an ERISA plan was ambiguous. Here, we don't think there's any latent ambiguity. Pennsylvania DOMA doesn't introduce a latent ambiguity, and neither ERISA nor the Internal Revenue Code introduces an ambiguity because, as our opponents are now apparently conceding, neither of them prescribes a definition of spouse or a definition of married for plans to use. And as I've already pointed out, this is not a case where there's a latent ambiguity because there are multiple spouses. There's only one spouse in this case. However, the court asked, if the term is ambiguous, what extrinsic evidence would need to be considered in order to determine its meaning? And the answer to that question is that if the court finds an ambiguity, it would need to look to extrinsic evidence to determine the party's intent. And that's the objective manifestations of the party's intent. That's what the Third Circuit held in the Baldwin case. And for this purpose, it's instructive to place this plan in an historical and statutory context. The operative plan document here was adopted in 2002. And at that time, the Federal Defense of Marriage Act had been effective for 6 years. Yet the plan document does not include that law in the choice of law provision, nor does the plan's definition of spouse incorporate the DOMA definition. The summary plan description, or SPD, was promulgated in 2009. And while the SPD does not establish the terms of the plan, it's an extremely important document in the ERISA scheme because it's the document where the plan sponsor explains to the plan participants in language that they can understand what their rights and obligations are under the plan. So by 2009, when this summary plan description came out, four states and Canada were licensing same-sex marriages, and California was recognizing the marriage of 18,000 couples who were married there in 2008, same-sex couples. COSIN had two offices in California in 2009, as well as an office in Toronto, Canada, yet COSIN stayed the course in drafting this SPD. The SPD continues to tell employees that all spouses who have been married for at least a year are entitled to spousal benefits. So this extrinsic evidence, if the court gets to extrinsic evidence, would support the conclusion that COSIN did not intend DOMA to affect the interpretation of the plan and did not intend to change the plan's inclusive definition of spouse to exclude the increasing numbers of legally married same-sex spouses who are out there as this plan continues to contain the same language.
Given the conflict, is there any reason why someone such as Ms. Tobitz would not be able to simply write in the name of the person she intended to be her beneficiary on the beneficiary line?
There's no reason that Ms. Farley could not designate
Ms. Farley, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Ms. Farley could have designated Ms. Tobitz beneficiary using a beneficiary designation form for the plan. She didn't do that. She never completed there was no beneficiary designation form that was ever submitted during Ms. Farley's lifetime. There was a beneficiary designation form that was submitted after her death, but it's defective in numerous ways, including that the signature line for the spouse is notarized, but there's no spousal signature.
Is that an issue in this case?
It has not been an issue up to this point, Your Honor. It was one of the bases for COSIN's interpleader, that COSIN determined that it was not able to follow this beneficiary designation that had been submitted to it because of the irregularities in the signatures and numerous other problems with this beneficiary designation. And the Farleys have essentially disclaimed reliance on the beneficiary designation in making their motions that are pending here today. So it's possible that it could become an issue in the case down the line, but currently it's not an issue. I would point out with reference to the beneficiary designation, since we're there, the answer to Your Honor's question about the breach of fiduciary duty claim. The breach of fiduciary duty claim is in the alternative to the claim for benefits under the terms of the plan. So if the court determines that Ms. Tobitz is entitled to benefits under the terms of the plan, then the breach of fiduciary duty claim is moot. But the premise of the breach of fiduciary duty claim is that if, contrary to the arguments that we've made today, the plan term spouse does exclude same-sex spouses, then COSIN breached its fiduciary duty by failing to communicate that fact both to its participants in general and to Ellen Farley in particular. The breach of fiduciary duty claim against COSIN has two parts. Ms. Tobitz alleges that if same-sex spouses are excluded under the plan, then COSIN violated its obligation to provide a complete and accurate summary plan description. A summary plan description under the statute has to describe the eligibility requirements under the plan, the eligibility requirements to obtain benefits, and also any circumstances that may result in disqualification, ineligibility, or denial or loss of benefits. That's ERISA Section 102.
Is it a part of this record anywhere that companies across this country, when they are devising ERISA benefits, have that actual language about same-sex marriage within those documents?
That's an evidentiary showing, and we're at the pleading stage.
Sure.
So no, we have not submitted evidence of that. There is evidence out there that's probably subject to judicial notice, such as the Human Rights Campaign Fund, the Human Rights Campaign's footnote in their brief regarding the number of plans that provide benefits to same-sex spouses, pension plans. In the health plan context, because health plans are often insured and states can regulate ERISA plans through insurance contracts, there are numerous states that require that same-sex spouses, civil union partners, domestic partners be treated as spouses under insurance policies in the state. California is one, New York is another, Connecticut is another. So ERISA plans in those states that are funded by the purchase of insurance are absolutely using the term spouse to provide benefits to same-sex spouses and other, you know, state-recognized equivalent relationships.
Let me ask you to jump to the question of how Ms. Tobitz has standing to bring an action regarding breach of fiduciary duty against COSA.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So Ms. Tobitz has standing on two bases. One, she has standing because she has a colorable claim to benefits under the plan. And for ERISA standing purposes, for standing as a beneficiary, that's what you need. You need a colorable claim to benefits under the plan.
And how does she have a colorable claim?
If we didn't have a colorable claim here, presumably there wouldn't be an interpleader. But you know, her colorable claim is based on the fact that she is a spouse within the meaning of the plan. She is a spouse who was married to a participant for at least a year as of the date of the participant's death.
That she's making that allegation.
Yes. Secondly, Ms. Tobitz has standing to make the breach of fiduciary duty claim on behalf of Ellen Farley. And that's because the Illinois court has appointed Ellen as the administrator and personal representative of Ms. Farley, has appointed Ms. Tobitz as the administrator and personal representative of Ms. Farley. So therefore, she has standing to pursue
that continues?
It does continue, yes. That is the current state of affairs. She is the personal representative of the estate, and she has standing to pursue the claim on behalf of Ms. Farley. Again, this is an alternative claim, and the arguments that I've presented here today and presented in our briefs demonstrate that Jennifer Tobitz is entitled to a surviving spouse benefit under the terms of the plan. I'd like to turn the podium over to Mr. Minter to address the constitutional issues now, unless the court has further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Shannon Minter on behalf of Jennifer Tobitz, and I'll be addressing the constitutional issues, which are G through L in the court's order. Now, in Romer, the Supreme Court noted that it's very unusual for a law to single out a certain class of citizens for disfavored legal treatment. And DOMA is a particularly extreme and harmful example of just such a law. And if this court finds that DOMA has any application to this case, shouldn't hesitate to strike DOMA down. First, DOMA openly targets gay people and subjects them to systemic federal government discrimination. Second, when Congress enacted DOMA in 1996, it was very candid about the fact that it did so in order to penalize gay people because it wanted to express its moral disapproval of gay people. And then third, unlike most laws, DOMA actually hurts gay people and their children without benefiting anybody. DOMA did not change anything about the rights of heterosexual married couples under federal law. They're exactly the same with DOMA or without DOMA. The only thing that DOMA did was withdraw protections and rights from a subset of married couples, namely same-sex couples. So mostly for those reasons, at least four federal courts have recently held that DOMA violates the federal equal protection guarantee, even under rational basis review.
Counsel, let me ask you to get into consideration. If, as counsel for the Farleys argue, there has to be a marriage, and here, there are three separate reasons why there is no marriage. And under Illinois' DOMA, if on the one hand it says that they cannot be of the same sex, yet the civil union says it's to be treated as if they were, how does that become reconcilable?
Well, Your Honor, we actually litigate that issue all over the country because it's very common for both historically and in the current day for states to not permit a certain type of marriage within their own borders, but to nonetheless extend comity to out-of-state marriages that could not have been entered in the home state, but that were validly entered elsewhere. That certainly happened during the era.
I understand that, but my question is in terms of comity, if, as the Follies argue, there was no legal marriage even in Illinois, there's nothing to give comity to.
Oh, well, the Jennifer Tobitz and Ellen Farley were legally married in Canada, and the Canadian Attorney General never took the position that those marriages were in jeopardy. That was a trial attorney working for the state who took that position in a pleading before the court without authorization. Both the Canadian Prime Minister and the Attorney General immediately corrected that misperception, and the only reason there's any discussion in Canada of a law addressing that issue is to redress the worry and concern that this incident elicited, and only to clarify existing law, not to change the law. There is no question that Canadian marriages entered into by same-sex couples from the United States are absolutely valid. So that was a valid marriage. Then in Illinois, Illinois does not permit same-sex couples to marry. It did not do so at the time Jennifer and Ellen married. However, the question of whether Illinois would have nonetheless recognized a valid marriage between a same-sex couple from another jurisdiction is an open question. And given that Illinois does not have a statute that specifically says we will not recognize valid same-sex marriages from other jurisdictions, the presumption is you look to Illinois comity law, which very strongly has the same rule that most states do, of recognizing a valid out-of-state marriage. And now so the presumption should be that under Illinois comity law, in the absence of any contrary statute, that the marriage would have been entitled to respect. And now we know that is correct because Illinois has affirmatively enacted legislation saying, yes, indeed, we do recognize valid out-of-state marriages, and we've made specific provision for them in our state law.
Right.
Which is an anomalous position that a number of U.S. states are now in. New York used to be. It now allows same-sex couples to marry. Maryland is in that situation at the moment. California is in that situation at the moment. It's part of the historical evolution, and it was something that we also saw with during the era of states barring, some states barring interracial marriages. And we still see it actually with common law marriages. There's a few states that still permit common law marriages. Most states don't, but if you are enter into a valid common law marriage in one of the states that permits it and move to another state that does not permit it, every state will recognize that common law marriage. So there's really nothing unusual.
Just as an aside, does the fact that ERISA does not speak to common law marriage and DOMA does not speak to common law marriage in any way invalidate in terms of someone being able to receive a pension?
No. There would be no question under ERISA or DOMA that somebody a heterosexual couple who entered into a common law marriage, that would be considered a legal spouse. And if you're entitled to a benefit as a surviving spouse or a spouse, you're going to get that benefit. I mean, that's part of what is so unusual about DOMA, and also, as many courts now have pointed out, why the rationales that have been put forward by Blagg kind of 16 years after the fact in an effort to come up with some way to find some sort of non-invidious justification for DOMA, which is difficult to do, to come up with these rationales of, well, it's DOMA is justified by trying to maintain consistency or uniformity or maintaining the status quo.
Let me hear from you regarding this not being a gender discrimination issue.
Ms. Tobitz has argued that the statute, DOMA, does discriminate based on gender, and we would particularly urge the court to take a look at the analysis by Judge Walker in the Perry decision. It's a very sophisticated presentation of the really close interrelationship between sexual orientation and sex discrimination. Sexual orientation, by definition, is about being attracted to a person of the same sex. So kind of sex or gender lies at the basis of it. And not to put too fine a point on it, Your Honor, but if Jennifer Tobitz were a man, we would not be in the courtroom here this afternoon. I mean, there simply would be no question that she was entitled to receive that benefit. This is sex discrimination in the most in its sort of most literal manifestation. A right that would be available if a person were a man is not available to her because she's a woman. Really, the sex discrimination is very apparent on the face of the statute, and it also discriminates based on sexual orientation. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has already established that sex-based classifications are subject to heightened scrutiny. We've asked Your Honor to consider whether sexual orientation-based classifications also should be subject to heightened scrutiny. And the Department of Justice of the United States has presented a very eloquent amicus brief on that point, so I don't want to belabor it. But I just would quickly note that to the extent that Blagg and some of its amici are trying to argue that heightened scrutiny is precluded for gay people because somehow sexual orientation is not the same kind of deep-seated identity characteristic as other classification, other characteristics that get heightened scrutiny. Now, that has really been precluded, foreclosed, and pretty definitively so by the U.S. Supreme Court in Lawrence v. Texas, and then more recently in the Christian Legal Society versus Martinez case, where the court addressed that very squarely and held, quote, "Our decisions have declined to distinguish between status and conduct in this context."
Is there any need in any way in interpreting this kind of issue or deciding this kind of issue to have an independent hearing for experts to testify about that kind of thing?
You know, under the Supreme Court's precedents, the only two factors that the court has held are both necessary and sufficient to establish that a particular characteristic, a classification based on that characteristic, gets heightened scrutiny, are that the group has experienced a history of discrimination and that the characteristic is unrelated to a person's ability to participate in or contribute to society. And with respect to sexual orientation, both of those dispositive necessary factors are so clearly well established that we believe this court could and should find on the pleadings before it that heightened scrutiny should apply. But if the court is not inclined to do that, we, Ms. Tobitz, would like an opportunity, if you have any questions about those factors or the others, to present a factual record like the one that was presented in Gill and Galinsky as well, although we do believe that you could decide this issue as a matter of law, given the overwhelming consensus that sexual orientation is not related to a person's ability to participate in society, and given the clear consensus. So every court that has ever considered the matter, even those that have rejected heightened scrutiny, have acknowledged that gay people have suffered a history of discrimination, and really any dispute has come around immutability or political powerlessness. I did want
to. And as to the issue of Pennsylvania DOMA, would it be inappropriate for the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to make that determination?
It would not be inappropriate. I don't believe it would be necessary unless Your Honor rejected a lot of arguments. We have argued that the statute doesn't control the definition of spouse in the plan, and why, if it did, it would be preempted. And I think it's significant that Cozen understands that and has not attempted itself in any way to rely on the Pennsylvania DOMA. And so we're in the position that the only party that's arguing that Pennsylvania's DOMA has any pertinence here are the Farleys. And we have tried to explain in our briefs why we don't think that's correct. We don't think it applies at all, but even if it had any sort of relevance here, just by its plain terms, that statute only applies to marriages in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as an initial matter. Then kind of the next layer is that the Pennsylvania courts have never applied the Pennsylvania DOMA to deny any right associated with marriage, any incident of marriage, and it's highly unlikely that they would do so in this particular context, that the courts would hold that the existence of that statute precluded Ms. Tobits from being able to receive the benefit under a private employer plan. It's not clear that the statute even applies to private actors, and we would argue that it establishes a legal definition for the state of Pennsylvania, but that would not be binding on private parties. And then if it did, if we could get past all that and the court nonetheless concluded that it applied and somehow compelled the denial of that benefit, well then, you know, we'd have to look as well to Pennsylvania's own Equal Rights Amendment, Equal Protection and Due Process clauses. And at that point, if the court did get to that juncture, it would be appropriate, if the court wished, to ask the Pennsylvania courts to weigh in. But I really can't stress strongly enough how much we do not think that is required in this case. That would, from our point of view, be a real red herring from the core issues that are presented here, because of those threshold issues. The PA DOMA just has really no relevance to the issues, in our view, to the issues before the court. On the real quick on the immutability point, I did just want to point out that, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized a number of classifications that get heightened scrutiny: religion, alienage, legitimacy, where obviously the court is not applying any sort of literal or biologically deterministic notion of immutability. And if you look at that term as a constitutional term of art, it's very clear that the court is talking about characteristics that are so central or fundamental to a person's identity that an individual shouldn't have to change the characteristic or try to change it in order to avoid government discrimination. And we believe that sexual orientation very clearly meets that criteria. And then just real quick,
I have to ask this question. It's been there, and I can't purge it. But under the present scenario with ERISA and spouse, if Chastity Bono changes to Chaz Bono, is it effective?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And
during the course of a marriage.
Right, right. Again, that's
and no divorce.
Right. That is an issue that we have brought to a number of federal agencies. It's not your example is hypothetical, but we have a number of real life cases. In fact, it is not uncommon for two people of the opposite sex to enter into a marriage, and then one of the partners undergoes a gender transition, and the result is what appears to be a quote-unquote same-sex marriage. But we think if you look at the law on that, I think it's pretty clear that the character, the nature, the legal status of a marriage is determined at the time of the marriage, and that is the position that has been taken by so far every federal agency that's looked at it, which includes the IRS, Social Security Administration, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service. All agree with that assessment, that those marriages are not rendered invalid by the existence of DOMA, which would be pretty shocking to automatically unmarry couples who in some cases have been married for decades and very much want to continue to stay married. Your Honor, I think I've hit on everything I was going to address with you, and I know our time is short, but if you have any additional questions, I would be...
Not at this time.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.